The Hundred Years' War, the Duguesclin period, the end of English in Portugal, and plans for Flanders. So this is a little short, two little short sections before we get into good old Bishop Despenser's invasion of France and Flanders. Now, the Earl of Cambridge arrived in England with the remnants of his army a few days before the Battle of Rosbeck. The men returned in Castilian ships in poor health without mounts or equipment, bringing them their tales of mutiny and betrayal. They were also sadly reduced in numbers. 41 large ships carried them to Portugal, but only 12 were required to bring them back. John of Gaunt had been counting on Cambridge to cling to his foothold in Portugal while he planned his next move against Castile. He was furious. He washed his hands of the returning army and refused to meet their outstanding wage bills. Even now, the Duke of Lancaster's cup of bitterness was not yet full. The Treaty of Badajoz proved to be the only of the first stage of a closer alliance between Portugal and Castile. During the winter of 1382-83, Fernando's health continued to deteriorate. He ceased to take even an intermittent part in the direction of this government, which was conducted in his name by Eleonora Teles, with the aid of a small coterie of close advisors. Her lover, Juan Fernandez Andero, her brother, João Alfonso Telo, Admiral of Portugal, Gonzalo Vasquez de Avendo, the king's confidant and now the queen's, and the constable, Alvaro Perez de Castro, who had helped him negotiate the treaty at Badajoz, and Martin, Bishop of Lisbon, the de facto leader of the Clementinist party in Portugal. Several of these men were in fact Castilians. Ecclesiastics, like the Bishop of Lisbon, or old Imperio Galados, like Andero and Castro, who had supported King Pedro's cause in Castile until his death, and then made new careers as exiles at the court of Portugal. All of them owed their positions to the queen's patronage. All were desperate to find a way of holding on the power after Don Fernando's death. In October 1382, they hit upon a radical solution. The Queen of Castile had recently died. Their plan was that John of Testamara should himself marry Princess Beatrice in place of his infant son John. They reasoned was far more likely to be applied the resource of his realm in defending Beatrice's interests if he were her husband rather than her appropriate prospective father-in-law. In particular, he could be expected to restrain the ambitions of Inez de Castro's sons, both of whom were living in his realm. Moreover, since John had two sons by his first marriage, his descendants by his two marriages would found distinct dynasties ruling in Castile and Portugal. In November 1382, Juan Fernandez Andero led a magnificent embassy to Castile to present the queen's proposals to John of Testamara. The winds of these events probably reached England early in 1383, when yet another emissary of Fernando's arrived at Westminster to wring his hands before the king's ministers. He was shortly followed by Florimond, Lord of Laspar, a Gascon prisoner of war in Castile, bearing proposals from John of Testamara himself for a peace conference at which the Lancastrian claims to his kingdom might simply be just bought out. Well, that's an interesting turn in Spain and Portugal. Now, let's see what good old Bishop Despenser is doing. On December the 21st, 1382, Bishop Despenser formally took the cross at St. Paul's Cross in London. Shortly afterwards, his commissioners began the tour of the provinces, preaching, granting absolution to all who signed up to fight in his army or contribute to the cost. A national sales campaign was launched, supported by meretricious marketing and mendacious claims of the indulgences, which went well beyond anything authorized by the Pope's bulls. The number of crusade preachers was swollen by impostors and confidence tricksters who forged their commissions and pocketed their receipts. The result was spectacular. A horde of men came forward. Gentlemen, monks, priests, ruffians, peasants, apprentices, tradesmen, rich and poor, all buying paradise. According to Froissart, however, professional men-at-arms held back. Quote, soldiers never go to war without money up front, end of quote, he observed. They can't live on pardons. But the bishop's chests were filled with coin, gold and silver and jewelry contributed by the faithful. He could afford to pay them. The king's ministers, as ever responding to events as they happened, were in a quandary. They were vitally affected by the fortunes of the Flemish rebels and by English mercantile interests in the Low Countries. Moreover, with the demise of the path of Portugal, the path of Flanders was the only aggressive strategy open to them. But in the council's views, the Bishop of Norwich was a wrong man for the job. They had serious misgivings about the sort of amateur soldiers which he was likely to recruit and about his own suitability as commander. They were also concerned about allowing him to roam over the continent free of any direct political control by the king's officers. So on about December the 12th, 1382, a week after authorizing the bishop's recruitment campaign, the council tried to upstage him. They announced that the king would raise his own army and lead it to Flanders in person. The object would be to relieve the blockade of Ghent and expel the French from Flanders. The government's plan must have been too absorbed to absorb the crusaders into the ranks of the royal army. They probably hoped to appropriate the bishop's funds as well. The scheme was endorsed by the lay and ecclesiastical magnates and a great body of military men at a great council which met in January of 1383. A knight was sent to Ghent with a message that help would soon be on its way. A committee of representatives of Ghent and exiles from Bruges and Ypres established itself in London to support the enterprise. Francis Ackerman, one of Ghent's three captains, had appointed himself Admiral of Flanders. He arrived in England at the beginning of January with a squadron of 9 ships raised in the harbors of Verambachten and put them at the disposal of the English government. Meanwhile, Peter van de Bosch in Ghent was planning to seize a port in western Flanders by which contact could be maintained with England and troops and supplies brought to the city. On January the 26, 1383, a large force of citizens and mercenaries of Ghent fell on Aardenburg, then an important harbor town in the estuary of the Zwijn near opposite Sluis. They took it by assault 3 days later, massacring its French garrison. The council's plan to make the invasion of Flanders a royal enterprise had much to be said for it, but it foundered on 2 obstacles. First was the opposition of the king. Richard didn't want to share Charles VI's enthusiasm for war and was reluctant to go. Without him, there was no one who could take command out of Despenser's hand as of right. The second problem was money. The single 10th and 15th voted by the commons in autumn was not enough to support the army of 6,000 men which the council had in mind. The great council advised that without a fresh parliamentary grant, it could not be done. Yet chances of another grant seemed remote given the ill grace with which the last one had been approved. And so it did prove to be impossible. So we'll get into a little bit of more discussion with Mr. Despenser and then hand him off to Flanders with this little crusade. Now the sources for this, the Hundred Years' War, the Chronicles by Froissart, the Hundred Years' War by Perrois, the Hundred Years' War by Nylans, and the Hundred Years' War, The House Divided, Volume 3, by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.